Thank you, Brother Ellie, and good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, at our last class, we were following David in this eventful journey of his, coming back out of exile and towards Jerusalem. We left him at the Jordan, having come out of from up at Mahanaim through Jordan, where some of the nation, particularly some from his own tribe, had actually come to meet him. And the record of his departure, as we saw last time, follows this structure, a chiasmic structure in the text that covers quite a few chapters. But chiasms are not actually just academic. It's not just put there for people to find from an academic point of view. Does anyone remember what the point of that is? What is that actually telling? Is that the Spirit has written this record in such a way that we're told of all that happened on the way out and then the way in? What is the point of that? Can anyone enlighten us?
Parenthesis?
What point? The point that it's talking about. Maybe true. What is the point? Because if we miss the point, brothers and sisters, we've missed what the Spirit is trying to tell us. If there's a structure here that's leading us somewhere, and you can see the sort of pointing down here, where's the focus? What is the focus? No. Jerusalem, yes, in one sense it is, but the purpose of this whole record, where is it leading us?
Providence with David.
Yeah, providence with David. But it's taking us to Mahanaim, right? That's in the centre. So David is being led to Mahanaim and then back out again. What actually happened at Mahanaim? That's what we've got to look at. And the Spirit is telling us to look there. What is happening at what happened at Mahanaim? Well, that's where Absalom was defeated. Is that actually what happened? No. You see, what was really going on, brothers and sisters, is that David voluntarily left this city a very broken man. And all the way he's meeting people, and it's getting worse and worse. And what it's doing to David, because the Psalms are absolutely full of this, David is pouring out his heart to his God. He has got no answers for anything. He doesn't know whether he's going to live or die. He doesn't know whether he'll ever go back to the throne. He doesn't know whether he'll ever see anyone back in the nation again. He doesn't know any of those things. And he pours himself out in a despairing cry through the Psalms. We've got many Psalms that tell us that. And by the time we got out to there, brothers and sisters, God dealt with his problem. Because he'd been calling on God and trusting him. He'd been letting go of everything that was all his schemes and everything that he would have at his disposal as a king. And God delivered him when he was powerless and answered his prayer. And all that happened, David was actually taken out there. God could have answered his prayer to get rid of Absalom when he was sitting on the throne in Jerusalem, but he didn't. He allowed David to go all the way out there through all these experiences, because every one of those was going to be crucial for David. It was important for David to get right out into Mahanaim, right away from the rest of the nation, having gone through all those experiences before God would finally snatch him out of the hands of his own son with an army that was way bigger than his own and deliver him. You know, brothers and sisters, that is the story of what God does in the lives of so many of the faithful saints and in our lives as well. So, but it doesn't all stop there. Once God has delivered him, and we're being focused to that point, once God has delivered him, it's not just as if he had a terrible time going out and now he's just got this wonderful ride in a limousine back to Jerusalem. It's not like that at all. Because, look, the same people are there and different experiences, but with the same different people come back to him. And it's by no means an easy ride as he comes back to take that throne, even though God is leading him back there. Well, we saw Shimei last time come down with all his retinue and David interact with him and make a promise to him. But now we pick up the story again in verse 24 of chapter 19 when Mephibosheth is there. And that must have surprised David. In fact, it certainly would have surprised David, because he wouldn't have thought that he was going to come. In fact, David had, it appears, quite a different view of Mephibosheth by this stage because of what he'd been told earlier. And we find that Mephibosheth here arrives on his own, and Ziba is not with him. Now, Ziba was his servant, the servant of Saul, who was supposed to be looking after his property and supplying, you know, goods and stuff for Mephibosheth and doing things for him. But we actually find Ziba is with Shimei and all the men of Benjamin. That's where he's mentioned a little earlier in this chapter. He's not standing with Mephibosheth. It appears that he hasn't even helped Mephibosheth come down. Mephibosheth has had to find some other way to actually get there. Verse 24 says, "And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king and had neither dressed his feet nor trimmed his beard nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came again in peace. And it came to pass when he was come to Jerusalem to meet the king." Now, most other translations change that. I think it's a helpful little thing to note in verse 25. For example, the NIV says, "And when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king." So it's not as if he waited until David got back to Jerusalem. He is down there at the Jordan when he'd come from Jerusalem down to meet the king. He'd made that trek. He's laying on his feet. He hasn't got Ziba to help him. This has been a very difficult exercise for him. That the king said unto him, "Wherefore wentest thou not with me, Mephibosheth?" That's a harsh thing to say, it seems on the surface, because he's asking him, "How come you didn't come with me when I left Jerusalem weeks ago?" Well, Mephibosheth is here not with Ziba, but he's on his own, and this story is actually quite tangled. Because you remember back in chapter 16, and I'll put something on the screen in just a second that just summarises this. But back in chapter 16 of 2 Samuel, Ziba meets David as he's going out up here. As he's going out, Ziba, as he just goes up over the brow of Olivet and so on, just down the other side, he meets Ziba. Ziba comes charging out of Jerusalem and actually meets him with all these goods and gives him donkeys and so on and helps him. And he tells David at that time that Mephibosheth was going to stay back in Jerusalem because he expected that he would be made king. And David's flabbergasted. David is in no fit state to be taking this on. Like, he's just found out that his own son is ganging up against him and has got the army behind him. He's made himself king, and now he's just leaving in weeping as he goes up over Mount of Olivet. And he meets Ziba on the other side of that, and Ziba says, "Oh, and Mephibosheth thinks he's going to be the king. He said he wouldn't come with you because he wants to be king." And David says, "Oh, Ziba, everything that was Mephibosheth's, you can have." And off goes Ziba. And now, when he comes back, here Mephibosheth is at the Jordan. No wonder David's perplexed. Is Mephibosheth going to be the next Shimei who's just going to prostrate himself and plead for something? Well, we don't find him doing that either, brothers and sisters. Verse 26, "And Mephibosheth answers, 'My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For thy servant said, I will saddle me an ass that I may ride thereon and go to the king, because thy servant is lame. And he hath slandered thy servant unto my lord the king. But my lord the king is as an angel of God. Do therefore what is good in thine eyes.'" Well, one of them's telling lies, aren't they? They have to be. Because here's Ziba's story, that Mephibosheth wanted to stay in Jerusalem because he expected to be king. When David comes up with Mephibosheth, he says, I desperately wanted to go with you, David, but I couldn't leave because I was lame. And Ziba deceived me and he slandered me when he talked to you. Well, we've got to make up our mind. David had to make up his mind here. What's going on? You know, it appeared that David believed Ziba. The reason is that he gave him all that belonged to Mephibosheth at that time. But the interesting thing is, Ziba was actually quite happy while David was away, and he was very, very anxious when he knew David was coming back. He was down there like a flash as soon as he'd heard that the men of Judah were going down. He attached himself to them and to Shimei and in the company of all that, and he says nothing in the record. He just stays there, hoping that no one knows too much about what's going on. It's almost certain, in my view, that Ziba is the false one here and Mephibosheth is telling the truth. Because what we find here is not Mephibosheth saying this, but the Spirit telling us here in verse 24 what happened to Mephibosheth. That he was so distraught when David left that he hadn't dressed his feet or trimmed his beard or washed his... because all he wanted was the king to come back in peace. Now that is not Mephibosheth talking. That's the divine penman saying, this is how Mephibosheth was. And notice, brothers and sisters, if you've got a colour pencil, do this, because there it sort of says he didn't do this until the day he came back in peace. That's verse 24. But the whole of this little bit with Mephibosheth ends with exactly the same little phrase. Because Mephibosheth himself says this now in verse 30. Yea, let him take all for as much as the Lord the king is come again in peace unto his own house. The only thing Mephibosheth wanted was the peace for the king who had done so much for him. So this it appears that Mephibosheth's story was actually quite genuine. And he had an amazing attitude when you read through verses 26 to 28. We've read a bit of that. We don't need to read the whole lot of it now. We've read it just a little earlier. But he's mourning the whole time David's away. He's humble before him. He views David not in a fawning way, but he views David as if he were an angel of God, and he could clearly discern what was going on. And so we find that there in verse 29, and the king said unto him, why speakest thou any more of thy matters? I have said, thou and Ziba divide the land. So it appears on the surface here that David actually was perhaps possibly a little irritated. It reads that way in the record, and he may well have been, brothers and sisters, possibly irritated at himself at the realization that Ziba had actually pulled the wool over his eyes earlier, and it caused him to actually make a promise to Ziba about transferring all the properties from Mephibosheth. And it's clear also from the record here that David actually now, at least partly, believed the story of Mephibosheth, because he changed those arrangements now, once he'd heard the other side of the story. The question is, how come David didn't actually just harshly deal with Ziba right now? Well, you can bet your bottom dollar that Ziba is just not there at the moment. If Ziba, the kind of man he was, if Mephibosheth's story is true, there is no way Ziba was going to be seen around when he saw Mephibosheth go and talk to David. He knew exactly what that was going to mean. And he would have made himself scarce. He's scarce in the record. He doesn't appear, apart from that we know he first came down. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't try and agitate. He doesn't try and make a profession of guilt. He doesn't do anything, because he's just a politician who's hoping things are all going to sort themselves out and it's all going to go away. But I suppose to ask the question, why did David not deal with him harshly? Why didn't he take everything from Ziba? Well, David on this occasion was an amazing man that probably did not behave as any other king ever has. He's just returned from a shocking situation where the nation turned against him, where people should have lost their lives, there should have been many questions answered, a lot of people should have met the sword. And even Shimei was pardoned that day. Because David said, no one this day, since God had saved David out of all of that trouble, David was not going to take anyone's life or harshly reap punishment on anyone. So he just returns the status quo to Mephibosheth and Ziba, because before Ziba went running off to David and told him all this pack of lies, the arrangement was, Ziba, you look after all the land that's Mephibosheth's, you can eat off it, but you give the rest to him. You give the rest to Mephibosheth. It's his land, it's his goods. You can eat what you need to just for your own use, but that's where it is. And so I think that's what David is saying here when he says, look, yes, he might sound a bit annoyed in verse 29, but I've said, divide the land. That is, go back to where we were. But the spirit of Mephibosheth is actually quite amazing, because as we read just a minute ago in verse 30, Mephibosheth says to the king, yea, let him take all, for as much as my lord the king has come again in peace unto his own house. Let him take all, if it means so much. He was only concerned about the peace of his master. He wasn't a grabbing materialist like Ziba. You know, Mephibosheth in the story, brothers and sisters, forms a very interesting parabolic pattern, because we've seen this before in an earlier class when we met in chapter 9, 2 Samuel chapter 9, we came across Mephibosheth and David's kindness to Mephibosheth and bringing him around his table. But Mephibosheth is actually a very interesting type of the saints through their hopelessness, the blessing that we have through our king and the hope for the future. But you know, the parable continues now that we have this next chapter of Mephibosheth's life. Because when the master is absent and then the king returns, there's a whole raft of things that happen in this little incident here which are just the same with us. Mourning for his master's return, deceived and slandered while the master is away. We can expect not much different, brothers and sisters. But it would be wonderful if we could respond the same way to injustice and slander as Mephibosheth did. To suffer unjustly is the lot of all the saints. He wasn't greedy for gain. He was aware of his own unworthiness. He was prepared to be like a servant. He had a profound love and respect for his master. He was overjoyed when he saw his master again. That's all he really wanted. He was interested in his master's peace. And he trusted the master as the judge. His greatest desire, brothers and sisters, is to be with the king. That's you and I, isn't it? And Mephibosheth, well, though he was a poor and wretched man with a disability and thought poorly of himself, yet he had some wonderful characteristics. But then in verse 31 we meet another man. Barzillai, the Gileadite, came down from Rogalim, and went over Jordan with the king to conduct him over Jordan. This man is, verse 32 as well. Now Barzillai was a very aged man, even 80 years old, and he had provided the king of sustenance while he lay at Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. Now, he's an old man. He's 80 years of age. And he provided for David, along with two others, unbidden. It was just his spirit. And he had come from Rogalim. You know, brothers and sisters, when you read straight past this, he's an 80-year-old man. He has travelled through the country, the hill country of Mount Ephraim, over 100 kilometres, just to come down to the Jordan to help David cross and to send him on his way. The NIV says he came to cross the Jordan with the king and to send him on his way from there. That's why he travelled with donkey and probably with some of his servants for over 100 kilometres down, 100 kilometres back at the age of 80, just to do that. He didn't come, brothers and sisters, like most others who came that day, to impress David or to seek favours or trying to deceive him. Barzillai was an amazing man in the record, and David thought so too. He was loyal and genuine, rich, but extremely generous. He sustained David and his troops for weeks and weeks while they were in that region. They had no means of support, and he mustered it. And he was a lover of David, brothers and sisters, because he was thankful for all that David had done and because he loved the same cause and the same God as David. And for that, he was prepared to risk everything. He wasn't going to side with any uprising like with Absalom. The rest of the nation had sort of fallen in behind that. But not a man like this. He knew who David was. And he was incredibly thankful for that. Verse 33, and the king said unto Barzillai, come thou over with me, and I'll feed thee with me in Jerusalem. You know, David was moved by this man's kindness. Because no doubt, as David saw often, when he saw particularly wonderful characteristics, he saw God working through those individuals. He saw the chesed, or the long-suffering, and the goodness of God working through an individual. And he was drawn to men like that, men and women like that. Because he himself was a man after God's own heart. And he saw that was a wonderfully godly characteristic that this lovely old man Barzillai had demonstrated. And it wasn't just that David said, oh, well, you did me a few good turns. You come back and have a few meals with me at the palace, or come and live, you know, for a few years, because you'll only be around for a while, so it won't really cost me very much. David didn't think like that at all. Not even in his head. And it's not about returning a favour. But it's an indication of a truly great man in Israel and a truly godly man in Israel, because David wanted this man as a companion. He wanted to take him into his own palace where he'd see him every day and he could have conversations with him, because he knew what his mind was like and what his character was like. It's just, this must have been an amazing breath of fresh air, a spiritual revival to David to find this wonderful man. He had appreciated him when he first came over to the area of Mahanaim, but now he travels all that way just to help him cross the Jordan. But verse 34 tells us, Barzillai said unto the king, how long have I to live that I should go with the king unto Jerusalem? I am this day 80 years of, and I can't discern this and that. So he declines. But verse 36 says, but I won't come over with you, because I'm just happy to die in my own land. Thy servant, verse 36, will go a little way over Jordan with the king. And why should the king recompense me with such a reward. He's not dazzled by status, brothers and sisters, he's, as other men were, or association with royalty, or the offer of a place in the palace. He loved David because of David's spirit, and he loved David's spirit because it was God's. And look at this. I just love this little phrase. Just take notice. You know, because sometimes, brothers and sisters, when we're reading the scriptures, we can just go straight across things because we read too quickly. We don't think. We don't have the time to just think, sit and pause. But just soak this. Verse 36. Thy servant will go a little way over the Jordan with the king. I think that's just a beautiful picture of the encouragement of this old man, of his support for God's anointed. Now, brothers and sisters, we can't take the journey for others. But one thing we can do is what Barzillai did. We can go a little way with them. And David must have been greatly encouraged by the spirit of this wonderful man whose interests were never on himself and always on others. So verse 37 says, "And let thy servant," Barzillai goes on, "I pray thee, turn back again, that I may die in mine own city and be buried by the grave of my father and my mother. But behold, thy servant Chimham, let him go over with my lord the king and do to him what shall seem good unto thee." And the king answered, "Chimham shall go over with me, and I will do to him that which seem good unto thee. And whatsoever shalt require of me, that will I do for thee." And all the people went over Jordan. When the king was come over, the king kissed Barzillai, the only one of whom it said, out of that whole company that came down, and blessed him. He returned to his own place. You know, it's, we're told about Chimham that Barzillai mentioned here. "Behold thy servant Chimham." It's almost certainly his son, Chimham. We know from 1 Kings 2 verse 7 that David gave Solomon advice about the sons of Barzillai who were eating at his table. And he asked him to continue that. Sons, not just one at least, but one of them here appears to be named, and his name is Chimham. And David took Chimham with him, and we hear nothing more about this. Not, that is, for another 400 years. And then his name suddenly pops up in the record of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 41, just let this go there for a minute. We're not going to stay here long, but Jeremiah 41 and verse 17. It just seems to be a mention out of the blue. Jeremiah 41 and verse 17. Chimham is long dead. And the background to this chapter, Jeremiah chapter 41, is that the Jews, led by Yohanan, had fled to Egypt after the murder of Gedaliah, and they stayed near Bethlehem on the way. So verse 17 says, "And they departed and dwelt in the habitation of Chimham, which is by Bethlehem, to go and enter into Egypt." Now, it's just a passing little reference here. They stayed at the habitation. It's the word is thought by most Hebrews to have the idea of being an inn, somewhere where people stayed, where travellers who didn't know their way stayed. So here was, it appears, they dwelt at this inn of Chimham, which is by Bethlehem, interestingly. Now, Chimham's inheritance wouldn't have been anywhere near Bethlehem. His father came from the other side of Jordan and had plenty. But it appears, brothers and sisters, though we can't be absolutely sure, but we ask the question, why on earth has Chimham got an inn or a habitation which is near Bethlehem, and why are we told? Well, David, it appears, took Chimham into his own house, to his own table, and he became like one of his own sons. And rather than just feeding him, as we know the spirit of David was, it may well have been that David had extended some of his own personal family inheritance from Bethlehem to his sons, including this new son whom he'd adopted, whom he'd taken with him because he couldn't take Barzillai with him. And Chimham appears to have had a property in Bethlehem. And 400 years later, it's a habitation for those who are passing through, who had nowhere to stay. There's been all sorts of conjecture about whether it was the inn where Jesus came, Mary and Joseph came, sorry. But none of that can be completely verified. But David saw that that deliverance that had happened to him out there as the hand of God, and as was always his spirit, he was generous to others in recognizing that wonderful character of God that he saw in men. And so David comes to Gilgal now from Jordan, moves a little way up, not very far, but it's where the men of Judah had gathered initially, and they helped him come over. We find that in verse 40. But verse 41 says, "And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, 'Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away and have brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over Jordan?'" You know, brothers and sisters, perhaps, again, we've just got to read the record really carefully. Can I just suggest how this should be read? There's this wonderful, warm story about Barzillai and David's heart warming and going out and asking him to come and stay with him in the palace. So he takes his son with him, and they come back to Gilgal and conduct him up towards, about to do this, going up towards Jerusalem. But the record says, and behold, that is actually meant to just sit us on edge. Something very much out of character that we need to take notice of happens here. All the men of Israel, at that very moment, the men of Israel came to the king and said to him, "Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away and have brought the king and his household and all David's men over Jordan? Why weren't we told?" David's almost shell-shocked. You know, in this record, David doesn't say anything. And I think David, who could have been a very decisive man on many occasions, was just shaking his head. And verse 42, "And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is near of kin to us. Wherefore then be angry for this matter? Have we eaten at all of the king's cost, or has he given us any gift? Have we done this because he got paid? Who do you think you are, accusing us of this?'" Oh, brothers and sisters, this is an amazingly petty concern. Have you stolen away the king? Oh, there was sort of a partial truth in this, in a sense that the men of Judah obviously hadn't told the rest of the nation. But was there a worse time for this to happen, for this petty squabbling to happen? David had just shown the most amazing humility and pardon, forgiveness undeservedly to people in the nation there who deserved to lose their heads. And in the very moment, next moment, they've got the men of Israel arguing about them stolen him away because they didn't listen to us and they didn't tell us. Goodness gracious me, you think, what on earth is going on? You know, the men of Judah Well, they could have settled that whole thing down, but they didn't. They inflamed it. Wherefore are you right to be angry? Oh, that's going to really calm things down, isn't it? I mean, in any conflict, as soon as somebody says something ridiculous, if someone pokes their finger in their eye and says, what are you, right, have you got to be angry? Well, they know that it's going to go another notch. That's exactly what happened here. The men of Israel were just so foolish to take offence over such a stupid thing. And the men of Judah, while they were neither magnanimous nor forbearing of their brothers, and they should have been, because they had the position to take the initiative. They were in a position to take the initiative. And not only that, they were the foremost in the rebellion of Absalom before. They were the most reluctant, the record has just told us a little while before, about calling David back. And it was only when David had gone out and shown the initiative to them that they had then come back with all great enthusiasm. But now they didn't tell anyone else and they just wanted David to themselves, and they go down there, and when the men of Israel realise that they've been left out or sidelined, they're angry. But the men of Judah are almost like the man in the parable who was forgiven 10,000 talents and then thought he had a right to actually have lots to say back and lots to do to his brother. Well, verse 43, and the men of Israel answered the men of Judah. So it comes back again. And they said, oh, we've got 10 parts in the king. We have also more right in David than ye. Why did ye despise us that our advice should not be first had in bringing our king back? And the words of the men of Judah were fierce, and the words of men of Israel are telling us, in summary, this thing just went on, up and up and up. And no one had the grace or the spiritual wisdom to de-escalate. Oh, you know, brothers and sisters, underline this little bit in verse 43. Look what this was all around. It's so petty and it's so utterly ugly. Why did you despise us because you did not seek our advice? That's what this was all about. At a time when David was being amazingly magnanimous. As one commentator beautifully said in a sentence, what a miserable tendency we have in our natures to take offence when we've been overlooked. When no one takes our advice or our opinion seriously. Brothers and sisters, no one, either side, ever emerges in a good light when men and women are contending that on some occasion they've been treated with too little consideration. It's a pathetic position for the saints of Christ to be in. Yet, how many controversies, brothers and sisters, how many quarrels, private or public, ecclesial or otherwise, have their roots here. And at the bottom of it all, there is pride. That's where this all started and escalated and kept on escalating. That same commentator, Blakey, he says this, there are wretched enough slaveries in the world, but the slavery of pride is perhaps the most mischievous and humiliating of all. And here it was, right in front of David, right at a time when his heart had just been lifted up with joy that finally he was going up to Jerusalem, and he was taking with him a new son, and he was going with the blessing of his wonderful friend, and Mephibosheth was going with him. You know, it's easy for us. We see this behaviour in children, don't we? We see this little quarrelling. Someone's been left out. Someone's been ignored. They didn't get their say, you know, all this sort of stuff. And parents are always dealing with this, you know, putting out little fires. The thing is, with children, quarrels pass very quickly unless adults take sides, of course. Then it all goes out pear-shaped. But with adults, Oh, it doesn't settle down that quickly because pride is more entrenched. And with groups of adults, it takes even longer. And with nations, it often doesn't ever heal because it goes on for generation after generation. And here, this, what was a petty, silly little quarrel about whose advice should be had and who wanted a say in bringing the king back over the nation, inflamed into a division. It spilled over into a rebellion in chapter 20. And years later, it inflamed and put a permanent division through the middle of the nation that will not be healed until Christ comes. That's where that little match started, here. At the very wrong time, we would have thought. Why? Why do this to David? Why come to David with this such a petty thing at this particular point when he's bearing all that he has? But the lessons are obvious, aren't they, brothers and sisters? The lessons personally and ecclesially are obvious. And the first thing to notice when we take the lesson is that the scripture and records like this are not given to us to correct others. They're given for us to focus on our own hearts. It's a third short one sentence quotation from that same commentator I was mentioning before, Blakey. This tendency to take offence, to stand up for our reasonable rights, is so deeply seated in human nature that we need to be so watchful against it and to know that it could break out at the most unreasonable times. And that's exactly what happened here. If only the men of Judah and the men of Israel had taken notice of their king and their leader, and instead of that, they added to his pain, and they dented his confidence, and they crushed his joy, and brought him crashing back to wondering whether anything had changed. You know, brothers and sisters, I wonder sometimes what we do to our master. It's very easy to see what these men did to David that day. But I wonder what we do to our master when little petty things get in the way. Think where we would be if he took offence at every want of honour that men threw at him. And yet he was prepared, as he said in his discourse on the mount, if a man smite thee on the right cheek, turn the other. And by that he didn't mean physically only. It could easily be verbal. And blessed, he said, are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. In the midst of all this escalating silly squabble, chapter 20, verse 1 says, and there just happened to be there a man of Belial whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. Well, well, well. There just happened to be a worthless man, a man of Belial. The NIV says, translate that as a troublemaker. You know, this is what Shimei called David, a man of Belial, in chapter 16, verse 7. A man of Belial. You know, without this petty infighting that was there, this man would have had no hearing, he would have got no traction. But look at what happens as soon as there is fighting and controversy, people's perceptions change. And this man, who was useless and worthless, he was a known troublemaker, he comes into the midst of that, he blows a trumpet, cries out, "We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance of the son of Jesse. Every man to your tents." And every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba. This is unbelievable. If those set of circumstances were not there, no one would have followed him. No one had been following him before this, and they wouldn't have followed him afterwards. And it wasn't long before they all dropped him. Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? We haven't got time to look at this in detail, but he's called a Benjamite here, and there's a few other Benjamites in this story, and we know what they're like. And this man may have even been connected by family to Saul, but the Benjamites that we know are Shimei, and we know what he was like, and all his 1,000 henchmen that he brought with him, and Ziba, all Benjamites, and here's another one. And he blew a trumpet. Now, again, there's a little bookends here in the record. He blew a trumpet. If you notice there, verse 1, and there's another trumpet blown in this chapter. Do you know where it is? Verse 22. Someone else blew a trumpet. To start with, it was Sheba blowing his own trumpet. And at the end, Joab blew a trumpet and ended the whole thing. And between those two things, there's a terrible, terrible fiasco that happens in the nation. It's just so utterly remarkable that here he cries out, "We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse." The whole nation's just been squabbling about how many parts they've got in David. "And we got more than you. We should have had more say." And now he comes along, blows a trumpet, yells out, "We got no part in David," and they all charge after him. It's just how fickle is human nature. "Every man to your tents." And what a remarkable echo that is 50-odd years later, because at the time when Rehoboam came onto the throne after Solomon's death, the men came to him and said, you know, he consulted with young and old and got their advice, and he came to them and he refused to alleviate the burden of taxation of the men of Israel. And the men of Israel cited the words of this man. I can't think for a moment that they would have been deliberately quoting these words, because if they were, that was self-condemnatory, because they could see what this cry did. "We have no part in David, no inheritance in the son of Jesse." And then what happened? Soon after that, this man's dead, his head's chopped off, the whole of his little dream just was completely smashed by God. But the same spirit arose in the hearts of those men of Israel in the times of Rehoboam, and it was an utter recipe for disaster and resulted in permanent division within the nation. But I think that it's worth us just pausing for a minute just to think about this man Sheba. Though a worthless man and useless, but he's in the record, and a whole chapter is devoted to what he caused, brothers and sisters, or what he at least capitalised on. You know, he exploited an evil moment in ecclesial history for his own personal gain. He had no regard for the welfare of the nation, and so it has been throughout ecclesial history. Acts 20 that we read on Sunday is a classic example. Men shall arise seeking a following. And the apostasy was to start that way, and it has always throughout history, whenever it has. And here was another example of people blowing their own trumpet and getting a following. And that's what he did. He wasn't concerned about the rest of the ecclesia. And a man's reaction to the needs of the ecclesia are really a measure of his true character. And Brother Harry Tennant had this to say in the book of Man David: our attitude to the body is our attitude to Christ. That's penetrating. The ecclesia is his body. And if we are superior to it, we lack humility. If we're divisive within it, we deny the atonement by which we are reconciled and made one. If we neglect it, we diminish our affection for him. If we serve it, we do him service. If we edify it, we continue his work. If we bind up its wounds, we take care of the weak. We fellowship his sufferings. True it is. And here was David in the midst of all of this, just eventually comes, verse 3, David came to his house at Jerusalem. You know, David neither expected nor wanted this controversy or this rebellion, but now it's on his hands. And it must have been a great grief to him just at the moment that he was recovering from the treachery and the disloyalty and the pain of the Absalom rebellion. The nation now breaks up and rejects him. What? This is just amazing. How come this is all happening? But you know, brothers and sisters, he came back to Jerusalem. I think that little phrase at the start of verse 3 is really, really instructive. And alongside that, you need to write 1 Samuel 15, verse 25. Because the very fact that he came back to Jerusalem was a reminder to David of Yahweh's favour and that he had not forgotten and that God was in control of everything. Because there in 1 Samuel 15, David said as he was leaving the city, he said, if I shall find favour in the eyes of Yahweh, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. Here was another opportunity for him to trust in his God and that he was in control. You know, brothers and sisters, I think through this part of David's life, the Spirit is telling us that real life experiences of the servant of God are not just on a smooth red carpet. Life is unpredictable. It's difficult at times. God does throw curve balls not to knock us over, but to help us, and only because he loves us and wants to grow our faith and develop a closer relationship with him. But this thing was going to get out of hand. Verse 4, then said the king to Amasa, assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days and you be present. And Amasa runs off and tries to do it, and he can't. He isn't able to. David is acting decisively now. This is just going to get completely out of hand if this man gets a fenced city somewhere and entrenches himself, and time was the essence. We don't know why Amasa failed, and it possibly could have been because the troops were just not really ready to accept his leadership, potentially as he was the failed captain from the other side, from Absalom's side. But whatever the reason, David, verse 6, says to Abishai, passing across the top of Joab at this stage, he says to him, you know, quickly take my bodyguard and Joab's men and the mighty men and get out there and start this chase. And so Abishai does so. And it wasn't until verse 8 when Amasa catches up with them. And we find in verse 8 that Joab has got a particular garment on. He's got his sword strapped onto him over the top of his war uniform. And whether or not this was a situation where Joab had sort of pre-thought out exactly how this was going to happen blow by blow, or whether the set of circumstances happened that his sword dropped out and he just capitalised on that very moment, very quick thinking. It doesn't matter, because Joab was determined that Amasa was not going to stay there. And then in verse 9, we know what the story is because we've read it here tonight. Verse 9 says, and Joab said to Amasa, art thou in health, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with the right hand to kiss him, but Amasa took no heed of the sword that was in Joab's hand, so he smote him therewith in the fifth rib and shed his bowels to the ground and struck him not again, and he died. And so Joab and Abishai his brother pursued after Sheba the son of Bichri. And here we have the real Joab. The Joab we've come to know, and this really seals it. Cunning, violent, vengeful man. You know, Proverbs 27 verse 6 is worth putting in the margin. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. In fact, two verses before that it says, wrath is cruel and anger is outrageous, but who is able to stand before envy? And this was horrific, cold-blooded, premeditated murder with a motive of envy. This ruthless and unemotional man just picked up his sword and kept on running. But all the army was totally mobilized by horror. They couldn't. Twice there in verse 12 we're told they just couldn't move. They couldn't move. They couldn't believe what they'd seen. Until one of Joab's men calls out and says, well, if you're for Joab, you're for David, they're the same cause. Come on, let's go. Let's cover up what's happened. So they dragged Amasa off to the side, put a garment over him, and then everyone moved on. As if that was going to fix everything. And as if Joab thought that was the end. But such was the man, who was just so unemotional and amoral that none of this mattered to him. And he emerges the undisputed commander. You know, brothers and sisters, I think what I might do is just in the last couple of minutes, I'm sorry if I can beg just a couple of minutes, just to finish. We're not going to look at any real detail at the rest of this chapter anyway. But there will be an opportunity for us to come back to Joab as a man, as a one of David's companions, as a man in David's life later, because he still emerges in the record for quite a while until the very last hours of David's life. But this was a man that David agonized over. He said, he is too hard for me. What have I in common with you, you sons of Zeruiah? And though he should have gotten rid of him, he was just unable to do so. He felt compromised. And God didn't take him out either. In fact, David tried to depose him, and he did on two occasions. He took him out of that top job, and Joab got himself back in there. And God allowed that to all happen, brothers and sisters. Why is this happening? What it would have been, you would have thought, so easy to just get rid of a general that had overstepped the mark multiple times. There was other mighty men that would have taken his head off quite willingly. But it reminds me, brothers and sisters, this whole story reminds me in one way of another very great man who was bothered by another person. And that man prayed three times, by which I understand it was much more, to God to remove this thorn in the flesh. You know who I'm talking about? It was the Apostle Paul. And that thorn in the flesh, I believe, was an individual. It wasn't just a disease or anything. It was an individual that was causing very great grief. He was opposing him. He was causing havoc in the ecclesia. And that's exactly what Joab was doing. And David could never see eye to eye with him. Why was he still there? Why was he still there? Well, maybe it's the same reason that Paul was given. Because when he prayed to God, God said to him, no, I'm not taking this man away. He's going to stay there. Because my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. See, brothers and sisters, that's exactly why Joab's still, to the very last hours of David's life, in his life. Not because he was the best general ever, though he was a great general. David needed him not as a warrior. David needed him as a stimulus to his own faith. And sometimes God won't remove circumstances or people that might be distressing us. We might think that he should, and that we can't cope any longer, and he needs to do something. We might pray over and over again, and he might say, brothers and sisters, like he said to Paul, and like I think he said to David, no, I'm going to leave that circumstance there so that God's strength can be perfected in our weakness, so that the Spirit of Christ can be developed in us. And you know what? I think the most wonderful thing is that the Apostle Paul shows us that that can be done joyfully. Look what he goes on to say. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. What an astounding thing that we can accept God's hand joyfully, knowing that he's working in us to develop our characters so that the Spirit of Christ might have opportunity to show itself in us. And I think that's exactly what we've been seeing in the life of David here too.